Hello, and welcome to episode number 164 of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and with me today is Ben Jackson, founder of For the Win, an employee onboarding consultancy advisory. Ben is a designer, engineer, editor, entrepreneur. He's the principal at For the Win, which he calls an advising firm. It's headquartered in Brooklyn, New York. The focus is design first employee onboarding. We'll find out what that means. He's been programming since 1992, 25 years. I am sure we both remember when CSS was new and sexy. He has been a director of mobile advice media, a mobile lead at Longform, an iOS lead for the New York Times, and he's written and edited bylines for the New Yorker, the Atlantic, Vice, and more. He also volunteers on the Curriculum Advisory Board at Coalition for Queens, and he's spoken at South by Southwest, Ignite New York, and Social Media Week. So, welcome, Ben Jackson.
Hey, how's it going? Nice to be here.
It's good. It's good. It's nice to have you here. I imagine it's sunny but cool today in Brooklyn, just as it is here in Manhattan.
Absolutely. It's a beautiful fall day.
Are you close to the river?
I am within walking distance of the river, but I'm about three stops into Brooklyn off Graham Avenue in Williamsburg, right on the border with Greenpoint.
So when you leave work, you're in Hipsterville.
When I leave work,
step out of your office,
yes,
you step into the streets of Williamsburg,
when I leave work, I step into it's a little bit of a parallel universe when you put it up next to the rest of the country. Yes,
I mean, there's Brooklyn and then there's Williamsburg, which is for listeners from other places, it's where you can get like artisanal whale tears. That's how I like to think of it.
I've been picking up the whale blubber myself.
It's very cool. It's very, I hate to say hipster because that implies a negative, and I don't mean to imply a negative. It's just like, seems like the best word. Just like I would have said beatnik about the village in the 1950s, I think. Although, you know what? Hipster maybe. I just may be showing my age, and it may not be hipster anymore. It may be something else now. Is there?
I don't know that there's a new word people are using to describe, I don't know, people who are into artsy things that are maybe a little bit obscure and a little bit twee. I think hipster is still, you know, it's still the word everyone uses. I like using words that everyone uses.
I do, too. You went to school you studied computer science, fine arts, and behavioral psychology.
Yeah, that was at the University of Pennsylvania in a program called Digital Media Design.
Did it ruin you for a while as a communicator, or was it helpful?
I think it was super helpful. You know, for me, you know, I started programming at a very, very young age. And I was not the best people person, let's say, as a child. And I think
really, you're intelligent and were drawn toward computer programming, and you somehow weren't a people person.
Yeah, tale as old as time.
Yeah.
But so I think definitely getting exposure to a fine arts curriculum in college, learning a bit more about how brains work, that actually upped my communication skills significantly. And then managing people many, many years later, just up them way, way, way more.
Yeah. You have to be a psychologist to manage people.
Mm-hmm.
And empathetic. And I know we overuse that word in our field, empathy, but you really have to have that.
Yeah, I think they underuse it in most of the other fields.
Yeah, I think they underuse it as a practice. I think we say it a lot. And your new business is kind of wholly rooted in empathy, right? Because you're an onboarding business.
Absolutely, yeah. Just
tell me how that works.
So I'm sure you've taken a job at some point, not been your own boss, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me what your new hire experience was like at the last job that you took.
That's like 40 years ago, but there's something going on in the background. I'm not sure what it is.
Oh, that is... Sorry, hold on one second.
No, stop.
There are two beautiful Puerto Rican golden mix puppies next to me that I am currently keeping an eye on for the week.
Okay.
And I will do my best to shush them.
They need a walk.
Interrupting the tape. I wish I could take them for a walk. They actually haven't been vaccinated yet. They're only 8 weeks, and so we can't take them outside, and we have them in this little metal cage with a couple of pee pads. They've learned to use the pee pads. One of them, there's Jaden, which is the alpha, and Alex, which is the smarter beta. And Alex has already, within like 24 hours, he figured out the connection between the pee pads and the treats. And so he has actually been holding in his wee to sort of meter it out in small drips to up his treat count. He's working the system.
That is fantastic. The smarter beta. I relate to that too, I think. Okay, so 8 weeks, dogs, and they're quiet again. That's wonderful. I thought someone was folding balloons or it's a weird, I mean, I don't know
they
what it's like in the room.
Just now learning how to bark.
Oh. So they're onboarding life.
They are onboarding into dog life. So tell me more about the last job that you took and where was it? What was that experience like when you joined?
Generally, I started doing a bunch of artist jobs because I got a liberal arts degree and then I got a master of fine arts. So I was unemployable and, you know, people expect you to know things and they think it's common sense and they get angry if you don't know things and you know other things, but you don't know those things. Every time I got a job, I know that folks kind of sold me on the job in ways that had nothing to do with the actual work. I never had a proper onboarding experience. I've had the experience of, I'll tell you, the last job I had, that was your question. I was a creative director at a startup company in 1999. It actually prompted me to start my own business for a lot of reasons. But and I love to talk, and there were a lot of good people at this company, and they made a great product, and I don't want to trash talk that company, and I won't say their name, but I was a creative director, and for the first 2 days at the job, I had a Macintosh computer and nothing on it. Nobody had put anything on it. So I went back home and brought my own Photoshop and everything and put it on their machine because, like, how was I supposed to do my job? And I think in those days, you still had to download and install browsers. If you weren't on the Windows platform, you actually had to think about and download browsers back in 1999. So I was doing that and I spent 2 days doing it. And I went from, I'm so excited, I'm finally a creative director and this company has a vision and we're going to really, I went from that to screw these people. I'm going to get paid to fine if they want to waste my time. They could have had anybody do this for me. I instantly became, now what are you doing? Are you on a subway?
I am not on a subway. No, they are, they're squealing, but also there is a street sweeper passing today because it's Tuesday.
Okay. They're gone now.
Yes.
Okay. So I basically went from an enthusiastic team member, I thought senior team member, finally getting the recognition I've been working toward for like 15 years, to a resentful employee who couldn't wait to go home and
ouch,
wondered what I was doing there. I mean, that was a particularly bad experience, but I don't think it was that unusual, especially this was the end of the dot-com boom. And I think you were just supposed to come on board and know what to do. And then nobody ever said, here are our principles. Here's how we do stuff. they came on and said, this is your developer. And I said, oh, I write my own code. I don't need a developer. They said, no, this is your developer. And I said, you mean my back end? He said, back end, front end, he does everything. I said, well, I'd like to write my own code for the front end, but I couldn't. So I had to do everything in Photoshop, which felt weird as a creative director. I loved my staff. I loved the designer. I loved the ornery developer. He argued with me all the time, but he was cool. He was very into usability. And I'd say, this happens in a pop-up. And he'd say, no, it does not. He was Russian. He was Russian also. He says, pop-up's bad. I mean, this is 1999, so forgive me. I was trying to be, you know, clever with some stuff. And he's like, no, pop-ups are bad. He was right. So the people were great, but there was no everyone was just sort of thrown into things and expected to figure out. And it, you know, I thought so. Somebody reported to me, but it wasn't. I was never told the developers report to you or the designer reports to you or what. I was just, I kind of made it up and tried not to be a jerk. And I like making stuff up, but then I was like, well, if I'm going to make this up, why don't I have my own company? I should have my own studio. It's silly to be responsible for so much of the product here and get so little of the money and get none of and not feel like you can really make a decision that matters.
How long did you last in that job?
5 months. And they said if I stayed one more month I'd be vested, and I said that's okay, and like 3 months later they were out of business again. There were a lot of reasons for that, and they were not an unusual company in that time, but I just I mainly worked alone, and I did best. I learned best working for myself.
And that's interesting. So less than 6 months. There's a stat that I love to quote from Bamboo HR that it's about 31% of people surveyed have left a job within 6 months. And of those people, there's about 16% who've left in the first week.
My favorite story was an apocryphal one about I think it's from
go on, please.
I think it's from those wonderful people who brought you Pearl Harbor by Jerry De La Famina. It's the advertising. Jerry De La Famina was this great ad man from the 70s, and he wrote all these, you know, stories about the wild times that they had, very much like Mad Men except real. It was the story of a guy who just, I don't know, he'd just taken a job at Leo Burnett. He's a copywriter. He's been there 5 minutes. And the phone rings, and it's his friend, and the friend says, what are you doing at Leo Burnett? Come over to, man, I've forgotten all the names. That's fast. Come over to Gray, and we'll have you working on Pepsi. So the guy says, okay, wouldn't be Gray, wouldn't be Pepsi, but okay. Guy says, indulge me. The guy says, oh, wow, Pepsi, sure. So he goes over to the other agency, and he starts working on Pepsi. And at the end of the day, he calls Leo Burnett's HR department, says, hi, HR, please. He says, hi, this is Joe Schwartz. I'm a copywriter, and today was my first day. They say, oh, that's nice, Mr. Schwartz. And he says, yeah, so I was on the job for 5 minutes, and I quit and took another job at Gray Advertising. And they go, oh? And he says, so I'm wondering how much of my vacation time I've accrued. There was definitely a that was polite of you. It seemed funnier in hindsight. But so, well, you asked me this question. I assume this is how you start advising, by asking questions?
That is that's most of how I do my job.
Right. And then what happens? And why did you ask, and where's this going?
Well, I asked because, you know, first off, you asked me, you know, what I do. And the easiest way to put it into context is, you know, to understand a little bit more about what your onboarding journey was like. And, you know, you also just saved me from having to explain what new hire onboarding is. It's the opposite of what you went through,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And, you know, I think the big mistake that most companies make with onboarding is they have no plan. And so every single time a manager brings on a new hire, they're basically reinventing the wheel, right?
Yep.
They're figuring out, okay, what do I do this time? Got to get them an email. I've got to get them a copy of Photoshop or Sketch or, you know, get them set up with kits, whatever the things are. And it's really, really difficult to keep track of all of those things. And so, you know, planning that new hire experience, it's something that, you know, people know is important, but that they just, it's so daunting. It's such a seemingly big task.
And it's not billable.
It is absolutely not billable. It's something that saves you money in the long run if you do it right. And if you don't do it, or if you do it poorly, you'll never know how much money you're losing. You'll never know what the impact is on your turnover and your ramp up.
Yep.
You know, and I think those two things, you know, employee turnover and what they call time to productivity or ramp up time, those are insane money sinks.
Right.
You know,
it was insane for me to be getting a creative director's salary to install software on a computer.
No, absolutely. You know, people waste about half of their time for the first 6 months at a job just doing that, you know, installing things on their computer, learning who's who, wasting time working on redundant projects because they don't know that another department might be doing the same thing. All of that's waste. You know, when people turn over, estimates are anywhere from 6 to 9 months salary to 2 to 3 years salary is the cost of replacing an employee that turns over.
Wow.
Yeah, and these are stats that, you know, they're not really common knowledge. And when you take, you know, a head of people or a CFO or somebody who's responsible for those things, you know, this is one of like, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 different things they have to worry about in terms of their bottom line. And it's not really reasonable to expect, you know, someone in those leadership positions to specialize in every one of those things.
Yep. I mean, we lost our editor-in-chief at a list department magazine due to illness. Micah McPheeters had to step down, and we have a great new editor-in-chief, Aaron Gustafson, and he's brilliant. We have a whole bunch of new people. Everyone needs to be onboarded, and we don't have processes for any of that. And the institutional knowledge is like, there's some in my head, there's some in our lead developer, Michelle Condu's head, there's some that we'll probably never see again in a former developer's head. Do you know what I mean? And so if there were only some tool or some helper that could say, you know, before a person leaves, put this stuff here and figure out what everybody's going to do. And to be fair, most people in Micah's position, and Mike herself, he was like, if I have to leave this, you know, there's all these things that are going to need to be filmed and all these things that are going to need to be done. And I want to write down and update all these things, but then you get sick and you don't have the chance and it's just gone. So we're spending, I can't tell you, I've got like 100 people right now volunteering in various capacities. And I spend at least half of my day every day interacting with them, which is great. But a lot of it is just getting them up to speed on stuff. And that's actually fine too. I think even if you have the documents, you want to take people through them. But what's your philosophy about all that?
About what specifically?
About a good onboarding experience, like, you know, documents versus people, activities.
I think a good onboarding experience is one, it's one that is right for the organization. And I say organization, not company, because, you know, nonprofits, onboard volunteers, all kinds of different organizations onboard different kinds of people. I was speaking with someone the other day about the Writers Guild, and they are onboarding tons of new journalists into their union. And, you know, these people, they have no idea what the union does for them. They have no idea what they can get out of it, how to take advantage of all the programs they have. And so they are not as happy with their union as they could be if they knew all those things. So I think, you know, tailoring it to the company is the most important thing. After that, really just consistency is the most important thing. Having a checklist, having that checklist for the HR department, for the manager, for the new hire themselves, having checklists for each individual team in addition to global checklists. And really the thing that distinguishes best-in-class onboarding from, you know, little to no onboarding is that it's treated as separate and sort of a larger thing than just orientation. You know, new hire orientation any company of a certain size, you come in and they're going to show you a video. They're going to have an HR rep with all the new hires from that week, and they're going to go through some of the things that you need to know. But at most companies, the onboarding stops, you know, after you leave that orientation session. They say, go find your desk. It's more or less over here. Stop by IT. They'll hopefully have a laptop waiting for you. And, you know, if you need access to third-party services, just ask someone. We'll get you what you need when you need it. And then the next month to 3 months is spent asking for things.
What got you interested? I mean, you've been a director of mobile. And mobile, you've been at Vice, you've been at Longform, you've been at the New York Times, three very, very interesting media companies. What made you say, where I really want to focus my efforts is on getting that first-time employee comfortably ensconced in the organization's thinking and preserving that relationship all through their employment? What got you into that?
Yeah, so... you know, I have been on both sides of the table, managing people and being managed, in a bunch of different companies, large ones and small ones. You know, I found across all of those experiences, the sort of unifying thread was that people in HR, people who run companies, when they're dealing with the public, their users, their customers, design comes first. When they're dealing with internal users, you know, whether it's like an internal facing CMS or just their expense tracking reports or anything that's not going out to the public, design comes last. So the first insight I had towards the end of my time at Vice was that you know, there might be an opening in the market for really great experience design for those internal facing things. And, you know, figured out who my customer was. It's the people who run HR, and the people they report to who sign off on the budgets. And I went out and I started talking to those people. And as I started talking to them, very quickly it became clear that within this, you know, what they call like the employee experience niche, the real problem they all want solved is onboarding. Everyone. I swear to God, everyone was just like, hey, you know, these are really cool ideas, but what we'd really, really love is for someone to just fix the onboarding problem.
Now, you've come up with an automated way to do some of that as well, I believe. You're working, or at least you're working on a chatbot called Aloha.
Yeah, that bot was approved and went live in the Slack app directory in early September.
Okay, so that just happened.
Yeah, that's an onboarding automation bot. I assume you're familiar with drip campaigns for marketing.
Yes.
So that same principle behind drip campaigns.
But our audience might not everyone.
Yeah. Let me give a little bit of context. Okay. So drip marketing is a technique where you get someone's email and then you email them on a schedule every few days, interesting, useful information. The idea that by building a relationship with your customer, eventually you'll convert them to something where they're paying you. And, you know, it's called a drip campaign because the messaging drips out in slow, regular intervals, much like a leaky faucet.
Okay. I've also heard it called a cadence, like building an email cadence. Mm-hmm. And I thought you were actually referring to a company by name because there's a company that does that.
There is a company called Drip. Yep. So it's basically that, but through Slack DM and for new hires. So when you join an organization, you will probably get a welcome message from Aloha that says, hi, welcome to organization name. Depending on how they've gone through the setup wizard, you might get a link to their code of conduct. You might also get a note that tells you all of the different channel types and what they're for. And you might also get a note that asks you to politely avoid the use of the channel and everyone mentions, which send push notifications to people's phones.
Okay. You call it Aloha, and it's open source, right? You made this product, but you basically just said, here you go.
Exactly.
And what was the attraction? Was it just you liked, you know, the idea of trying to have a machine do to some extent, what you do?
I think it was a few things. I've been interested in bot development for about a year. I had been wanting to do open source work as part of the strategy around this business. Not sell products for money, but give them away as a way of attracting potential customers for service work. And really, Aloha, the idea came because while when I started working with an organization called Swing Left, as their senior advisor for employee experience, I needed some way to quickly onboard people into the norms of their Slack. And they are bringing on volunteers at an incredible clip. And their community was growing to the point where it was starting to get a little bit unmanageable to the community management part of their Slack.
That's always a problem in community.
It is nuts.
I mean, successful community. The other problem is nobody joins. You have two problems. Nobody joins, and it's a failure, and you're sad. Or everybody joins, and then they're all like, now what do we do?
Mm-hmm. There's a third one, which is everybody joins, and then they don't actually come back. But that's a separate issue.
Oh, yeah, that's apps, though.
But so and I guess the other thing that really inspired this was I'm in a few non-work Slack communities. One of them is the RANS Leadership Slack. A guy named Michael Lopps, who goes by RANS, VP of Engineering at Slack. All of this is exposition for your audience.
Right. So RANS in Repose. So
RANS in
still,
Repose.
Does he still blog at RANS in Repose? I haven't checked it out.
I believe he does.
And I didn't know that he was at Slack now. I missed that.
He's
where was
VP
he before that? Slack. Anyway, he's at Slack now. Cool.
Yeah. So RANS has this leadership Slack, and there are a few others that I'm in. And in a lot of these leaderships, or a lot of these non-work Slacks, they have a welcome bot, and that welcome bot is usually a Python script that they've pulled from one of like two or three different Hello World chatbot examples on GitHub. Mm-hmm. And for you to install that script and welcome people, you have to go through a very complicated set of steps that include pulling a token from Slack, installing the bot yourself on a free server like Heroku. And it's really not something that's reasonable to ask of a non-technical person.
No, it needs onboarding.
And the other wrinkle to those things is they will send one message, and that is it. Which means that you're basically in a spot where anything that you might ever want to tell someone when they join your team, they're going to get that in like a 1,000-word message,
which nobody will read because they're overwhelmed, and then they won't remember how to get that information.
Exactly.
It's just like if you've ever worked with someone who sends you a super long email that contains everything, and then 6 months later when you ask a question, oh, that was in the email.
Exactly.
And it's fair. They were trying to do it. Or it's like the thing Corey Bin made fun of years ago when apps were first coming out. And this still happens on the New Yorkers app where you can go and look at, here's the 72 different gestures. Right,
it's the fine print, right? No one ever reads the fine print, and when you send someone more than 100 words, it's all fine print.
It's a camera app that has all this complexity to it and all this sophistication, but you basically have to memorize everything in that opening set of 23 screens, and you don't, and so then you just end up using the default camera app because you don't remember why you bought the other thing.
No, exactly. And that is, that's consumer facing onboarding. I think one of the big inspirations for me going into this sector of the market was Samuel Hulick's work on useronboard.com. And Sam Hulick is not a huge fan of those popover tooltip, hey, this button does this, that button does that, mm-hmm. Intro screens. And I love the way that he frames onboarding in terms of customer success. He has a little micro post about thinking of your product like the fire flower from Mario Brothers. And for anybody who didn't grow up playing Mario Brothers, the fire flower was a flower that if you grabbed it would let you shoot fireballs from your hands. Talking about the flower is not what's going to convince people to use your product. You know, he says, talking about the fact that this flower will let you shoot fireballs from your hand, that's really what gets people interested. And so, you know, I think...
Benefits, not features.
Benefits, not features, and really focusing on not what's important to you as the person right. designing that onboarding, but really putting yourself in the shoes of the people who are joining your company.
We're going to hear about those shoes, and we're going to talk about a broader trend of HR tech consumerization and conversational UE, which is part of what you've done here. But first, I have to take a short commercial break, so hang in there, sir. And let me first thank my sponsor, ZipRecruiter. This podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. In need of great talent for your business, but short on time? You don't have to get lost in a huge stack of resumes to find your perfect hire. You just need the right tools, smarter tools. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. So you can rest easy knowing your job's being seen by the right candidates. Then ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. And that's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. You can even get a head start on the interview process by adding screening questions to your job post to help identify the most qualified candidates. I love that. I love screening questions. So you don't have to waste time sorting through a stack of resumes to find the perfect fit. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And the easy-to-use ZipRecruiter dashboard lets you manage your hiring process from start to finish, all in one place. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, Big Web Show listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, absolutely free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. One more time. To post a job listing absolutely free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. And we thank you. And I thank you, Ben Jackson. We were talking about, oh, many things. We were talking about onboarding. I'm curious, have you read Justin Dower's book, Cultivating a Creative Culture?
I have not yet. I'm very excited to read that.
Justin was a guest on this very show 3 episodes ago, Big Web Show number 161. And he comes from a similar place. He approached it a different way, but he comes from a very similar place, which is let's apply the creativity and empathy that we're called upon as designers. Let's, in our jobs, let's apply that same creativity and empathy toward bringing people into the fold. It's very hard. It's a very challenging thing. Good onboarding.
Good onboarding makes all the difference.
Have you lectured about good onboarding? Have you ever given like tips for managers? I see that you speak at Ignite New York, Social Media Week, South by Southwest.
Spoken about onboarding yet. I've been running For the Win for about 4 months, and I have been focused on onboarding for about 2 months now through this company. So I am really, you know, just getting out into the market now. It's October 4th, right? But I'm really excited to get out there and do more talks and specifically to do more workshops. You know, I think that this is the type of work that while it's not super straightforward, it's also not rocket science once you learn the basics. I was going to talk just a little bit about what the work and you know, what it actually is and what we do with the clients, if you'd like.
Please do.
Yeah. So, It's basically, it's a thing called service design. It is the design of customer journeys. So we start by figuring out what the values of the company are, and identifying some of the challenges that people have come up against in their new hire experience in the past. And then with that as inputs, we break out the new hire journey step by step. So, for example, when the manager calls to give a verbal offer, that's one step. When HR emails the written offer, that's a separate step. And we try and make those steps as granular as possible so that we can pick them apart, figure out who are the people involved in this step. You know, where does this step happen? Is it at someone's desk? Is it on their phone? What are the systems involved? Are we dealing with Google Apps? Are we dealing with GitHub or something else? And really with the goal of figuring out what are the critical moments where things can break down for the new hire and how can we prevent those ahead of time? And what are some of the real opportunities that we haven't taken advantage of to reinforce those values and to cover what they call the four C's of onboarding? There's compliance, which is the one that most people get and that gets covered in orientation. There is also clarity around roles and responsibilities. There's culture, you know, understanding the culture of the organization you're at. excuse me. And then the last one is community, building a network of supportive peers around new hires to make sure that, you know, they've got people to ask stupid questions of, because most people, myself included, they hate asking stupid questions. They would much rather fake it than admit that they don't know what they're doing.
I've made a whole career out of that.
Haven't we all?
Yeah. The four C's. So, in these workshops, how, are they all day long? Or are they morning?
It's a flexible format. You know, I mean, I think some companies or some teams are really turned off by the idea of a full day workshop. Other teams are super excited at the idea of getting out of the office and eating a bunch of donuts and, you know, throwing post-its up on the wall.
So you really do it at your space?
It can be at the client space. It can be at a breather. It can be anywhere. I don't have a dedicated space as of yet, but, you know, as I ramp this business up and start booking more clients, that will be one of the first things that I look at.
Cool. I have a really nice, well, I like the yard. They're a nice, co-working space, a little more sedate than, WeWork.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them. I actually just saw there's a new space in Greenpoint called ADO, A/D/O, that opened up. And that is a free co-working space. I believe it's run by BMW Ventures.
Free.
And you walk in and you sit down and you've got space.
Can you say, I want this corner office and I want these five chairs and I want to... I want to be able to leave my laptop here overnight. I mean, is it like that?
I don't think that's in the cards. I think it's all hot desks.
Okay. But still, for that would be perfect for arranging the kinds of meetups you're talking about.
Yeah. We'll see what their space is like and if they've got you know, a room that people can book. And the most important thing with these workshops is that there be a space where everybody can be comfortable, plenty of wall space. Ideally, lots of natural light and quiet so that we can all focus on
the
work.
You know, in a way, you were talking earlier about having filters. Actually, I was talking about having filters when I was talking about ZipRecruiter. You can actually put filtering questions in. Anyway, but that's a filter for you. If a company is so uncomfortable with the idea of an all-day workshop, they probably can't fix their culture and you probably can't help them yet anyway. They have to suffer some more and then come to you. It'd be my guess. I don't mean that in a sadistic way. I mean, it's just like if somebody's got a drinking problem but they're still showing up at work, they're not ready to get sober. Mm-hmm. They have to get fired from three or four jobs and then they go, oh, I really do have a problem. It almost, you know, if a company thinks they can, if the idea of taking one day off to work together and learn more about each other is anathema to them, then probably it's kind of an uptight culture where everybody's under tremendous pressure, and onboarding is just the tip of the iceberg.
I mean, I think that's a really good point. I think, the reason why, at least at this stage, I want to be flexible on the format. In my experience, the consulting firms that are most successful are the ones that impose least upon their clients,
right?
And that make it easiest to work with them. So at least, at this stage, I don't want to be too prescriptive around format. Just going back to what I said earlier about the best onboarding being tailored to the organization, I think the process as well, really needs to be tailored to the organization.
Now, how did you start writing for The New Yorker and these other high-toned magazines?
So, let's see. Back in 2012, I had just left The New York Times. I was a freelance app developer. And back then, when you were a freelance app developer, life was, work for a month, 2 months, take a month, 2 months off, work for another month, 2 months, take a month, 2 months off. And so I had a lot of downtime. One of the things that I had been hoping to get a lot more into after leaving the New York Times was publishing, because at least back when I worked there, corporate communications was not super excited about employees on the digital side giving interviews or publishing or otherwise sort of, putting their sincere thoughts out there on the internet. So I left the New York Times. I said, okay, one of the first things I'm going to do, time to publish all that writing that's been sitting in my head.
Yep.
I started blogging a little bit. I got a little bit of recognition. I mean, Gruber linked a couple of my posts. A few others linked a couple of my posts. So I got a little bit of an audience. And I just started pitching editors. I met a woman named Courtney Boyd Myers, who at the time was an editor at the Next Web. I pitched her a piece. Mm-hmm. She greenlighted it. It went up. And then all of a sudden, I had written for the Next Web. And then the next byline after that was easier and easier and easier. I misspoke. My first byline, actually, it happened because I had written an essay for a quarterly called Distance Quarterly, by a guy named Nick DiZabato in Chicago.
I know Nick. He was a guest on the show a few weeks ago.
Nick is a wonderful man.
This is fantastic. Yeah.
Wonderful man. Has been a mentor of mine for years. I owe Nick so many things. It would take too much time on this podcast.
Nick D. He goes back to the mid-90s.
Yeah. So Nick and I, Nick edited a piece that I wrote for Distance Quarterly about game design and Skinner boxes. Skinner boxes, for anyone who's not familiar with them, are the little cages that a man named Edward Skinner put rats in the cages and gave them a couple of different levers, one of which would release food and the other of which would release cocaine. And those rats did not last very long.
They died.
And that is how that is one of the many experiments that led to the modern understanding of behavioral psychology. So I wrote this piece, and Nick was pitching a couple of the articles to Alexis Madrigal at The Atlantic for them to republish them and, push a little bit of traffic towards the book. And they picked mine. And so Alexis cut my piece down from like 3,000 or 4,000 words to about 12 or 1,300, put it up on the site. And so my first byline was actually at The Atlantic, which was a ridiculous stroke of luck. And then after that, I met Courtney at the Next Web, and the pitches just kept going.
I love stories like that. And I think everyone needs to hear them, that people aren't magical. And if someone has a tremendous, resume, it's that they've worked very hard and they have had a piece of luck. And part of getting that luck, I think, is persisting and not getting discouraged.
Oh, man, I paid my dues.
Yeah.
I paid my dues for about 6 years co-running a design agency with very, very little name recognition in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, which is...
Yeah, we haven't talked about that.
Hardest place to do business in the world outside of, I don't know, probably some places in the Middle East.
What happens if the customer's dissatisfied?
In Rio de Janeiro?
Yeah. Do you disappear?
It's not that you disappear. You know, when the customer is dissatisfied, it works much like in the United States when they're dissatisfied. I think the difference of doing business in Brazil and really specifically of doing business in Rio is people are just notoriously unreliable. Terribly unreliable. I remember there was a project where we were working on a dummy for a calendar that we were pitching on spec to an organization down there called SESCI. It was a cultural organization. And we had a really, really good shot of winning this particular contest. You know, these things in Brazil, I don't know how it is in America, but they usually have one or two people who are sort of the shoo-ins because they know somebody inside. Mm-hmm. We were one of a couple that actually had a shot, and we did not get that job because when we sent the dummy down to the client about an hour and a half to the south of Rio, we got a motorcycle courier, and that motorcycle courier just never showed up. The dummy was supposed to be there at 5 p.m. At 5:15, the client called us and said, "Hey, it's not here. What's going on? We can't hold much longer." At 5:45, they said, "Sorry, you lost. We can't, you know, we can't take it now." And at I think 6:30 or 7, you know, we finally were able to get a hold of the courier company, and the guy had gotten back and he said, "Oh, you know, I just wasn't able to deliver it," you know, after we paid for urgency on the delivery. So I think that the unreliability and the unpredictability of doing business in Rio, it, you know, I tell people that moving to the States, it's like I had been playing baseball for 6 years with that donut, the weighted donut they put on the bat, to warm up before they get to the plate. And I got here and, you know, it was like taking the donut off the bat.
Nice. I'm not a big sports fan, but I understand.
Yes. Baseball.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like taking those lead things that you put around your ankles.
Oh, God, the ankle weights. They used to give those to cross-country runners back in the 70s, yeah. And then they stopped doing it when all those people ended up having knee replacements.
Ooh, that sounds terrible. Well, Rio must be beautiful, though.
Rio is a beautiful place to live. There are mountains, and the mountains are about, depending on where you are, 3 to 4 blocks away from the beach. I lived in a house on a street called Emilio Berla. And Emilio Berla was a massive hill, a hill so steep that most of the taxis at the time would not take me home because their cars would not make it up the steep hill.
Wow.
And Emilio Berla was right on the border of a nature reserve called Parque da Catacumba. And Catacumba had like many, many monkeys. Hundreds and hundreds of monkeys, and those monkeys would climb on the trees outside of our windows, and so we would be working on the third floor of this house on this hill, and you would just look out the window, and there'd be like a monkey chewing on something on the branch, and you know, it sounds fantastical, but I'm telling the truth. I saw a battle, a treetop war, between two warring tribes of monkeys. And these monkeys, you know, they don't really have like sharp claws or teeth to hurt each other with. And so the way that they use lethal force in these battles is they will throw the other monkeys off the trees. And so it was raining monkeys outside my house for like half an hour.
Oh my. You know, I don't even need the film. I completely see it. You're a good storyteller. And I want to go there.
It's a wonderful, wonderful fantastic. Place.
I'm sorry for those monkeys, though.
Ah, circle of life, man.
Did you bring any home?
I did not. That's illegal.
Yeah, you can't do that. I was afraid of that. Do you have, and now you have dogs?
Well, I'm fostering these two puppies. I am not currently a dog owner. I'm an aspiring dog owner. I was recently turned on to dogs by a beautiful Alaskan Klee-Kai, which is a very special breed that's like a husky that was scaled down, preserving the stroke width. We discovered this husky through an app called Rover, which is like Tinder for dog sitting.
Wow, just give me a second. Okay, proceed.
So So we met this dog, Miko, and we have been sitting him on and off for like a year or so, more or less. It's funny because this app, you know, you're supposed to meet a bunch of dogs, and we just met one and said, yeah, we threw out the app. We just go with this one dog, and he's a very, very sweet dog. He looks like a husky, but he's a third of the size. So someday, hopefully, we will be the proud owners of our own dog. But for now, we're fostering, getting to understand a bit. I didn't grow up with dogs, so I don't know even the most basic things about dog psychology, dog training, how to hold them, how to reward them. So I've learned a lot with these puppies over the past 4 to 5 days, and there are two of them, so it's twice as challenging.
They're wonderful. You should. I would start with a mature dog, A, because they need rescuing and everyone wants puppies, and B, because you'll get the experience with animals that kind of know what they're doing and know what some of the rules are.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely been the nice thing about Miko, is that he was already trained.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. I had a dog named Anna Beasley when I was in college. Wonderful dog, but I'd never owned a dog. I'd always had cats, and I could not walk her. My girlfriend would come back, and she could walk her because she'd grown up with dogs. I would take Anna Beasley for a walk, and we'd go everywhere, and then we'd come home, and she'd pee on the floor. And this was just, I didn't know why, and I would get really, I wasn't as patient. I was a lot younger. I was less patient than I am now, and I'd get really frustrated and go, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And she'd just look at me like, I'm not trying to hurt you. I'm a perfect, radiant being of light. I love you, and now I'm going to pee on your floor again. We weren't connected.
I mean, I think training dogs is it's great training for a career in UX.
Yes. It's great training for client services.
Tell me about it.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, now I won't have any more clients. That's sad if they hear that.
We still have to talk about HR tech things, right?
Yeah, let's do that. So this is a thing now. HR was the least glamorous and least exciting and least catered to work division. I mean, you know, billing was sexy compared, right? We've had billing apps for 10 years that were pretty sexy and that were like battling, or like tax apps and that are like battling for our attention. But for HR tech consumerization, that's pretty new, is it not? What products do you like? What products should people be looking at?
Yeah, so I actually have a list of tools and services across all the different departments. So like everything from design to product management to HR and people.
Have you published that somewhere?
I have. I will give it to you for the show notes. And I host it on the first tool that I'll mention, which is a wiki called Notion. That's Notion.so. And Notion is... it's just a wiki that's easy to use, which, you know, shouldn't be a huge challenge to build, but clearly is, based on the other wikis I've used. It is super clean design, very few options in terms of customization. You know, all the pages look the same and they look clean. They've got system fonts on them, and everything just kind of ties together pretty quickly. Let's see. Other things that are on my list that I've been super interested in. CultureAmp is interesting. One of the more well-known ones. CultureAmp sends employee engagement surveys, and they help keep your finger on the pulse of how people in your company are feeling about the company, how likely they are to recommend it to their friends, whether or not people are thinking of leaving, and all that's done through anonymous services. There is a very, very new SaaS product that I've been looking at called Steer. That is a product for weekly check-ins, and that's built around a thing called objectives and key results, what a lot of people call OKRs. Mm-hmm. And OKRs are... It's like a cascading system of goals and milestones that starts at the top of the company. You know, the company has its objectives. I don't know, raise traffic or conversion. And the key results that will show that they're on their way towards doing that. And then each department, you know, under the president will have their OKRs. Each one of the sub-departments will have theirs. And eventually those trickle down into the line workers, you know, the direct reports who are actually doing the work. And those people have their OKRs as well, all of which, you know, theoretically, if you're doing this well, tie into the larger company goals. And that is done over weekly check-ins. I believe it's a Slack bot. I'm not mistaken. Let's see what else. So there are a bunch of applicant tracking systems. Applicant tracking systems are the most, I think the most widely used is Greenhouse. But basically anytime you go to a big company's career page and it looks good, but maybe not exactly like the rest of their website, it's probably because they're using one of these products. There's Greenhouse. Yes. There's one called Lever. There's one called Breezy that I've been using with Swing Left. That's the most affordable one that I found so far. And these products, you know, on the one hand, they help you promote your job listings, but they also help you standardize the interview process. And the thing that I love most, they help you standardize the scoring process. So that if you have, you know, 3, 4, 5 different people interviewing 5 to 10 candidates, and not all of them are interviewing every candidate, you can still get a reasonably consistent view into the performance of each candidate, even though the same people aren't interviewing them.
That's very challenging.
It's crazy, man. You know, it's, and like, you can.
I do.
You
can,
yeah, mm-hmm, go on.
I do a fair amount of judging of interactive award shows and whatnot, and. It's almost crazy that anyone, I mean, because every judge has definitely their own priorities, their own sense of what's good work and what's bad work. And some judges need to know what problem were you solving, and some judges want to be dazzled. And, you know, and this all filters through, and eventually someone wins. And I always think if people knew, it's like, it's the best thing we can come up with, but it's not exactly fair. It's not exactly even. Because every judge is so different. So the more that you can work to normalize across different people's personalities, I think the fairer to the candidates.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that I think gets really overlooked in onboarding and hiring in general is the candidate experience. You know, people think that onboarding starts when someone shows up for work. Really, onboarding starts the minute one of your recruiters reaches out to somebody to gauge interest. You know, that's the first touch point, the first interaction that they have with your company. And that's going to set their expectations and, you know, frame the way that they come in. And having a really organized candidate experience, God, it's so refreshing. It's crazy. Another couple of tools that in the hiring space that are really interesting are so there's a class of products, what we call like linters in software engineering.
Sure.
There's, you know, there's things that will tell you if your JavaScript is ugly because the spacing is off or you're, you know, not lining up the brackets correctly. There are the same type of product for job listings. So there's a free one called JobLint. That's joblint.org, not .com. And JobLint's been around for I don't know how many years, but a few years. And it is it will scan your listing and tell you if there's any things that imply you know, culture issues, recruiter fails, problems around expectation, sexism. That's a big one. There's another one that is a paid product called Textio. That's T-E-X-T-I-O.
Right.
And Textio is, I'm guessing, taking it a little bit further than JobLint. You know, analyzing your job listing on a bunch of things that aren't only limited to culture and expectation things. There are let's see, the whole like HR benefits and compliance space is full of these newer companies that are taking on a company called ADP. ADP is it's a type of company called a POE. They basically stand in as the employer of record for your company. For example, if payroll doesn't hit, they are the ones who take the knock with the government and not you. Right. If anything else goes wrong that, you know, would affect your compliance, they're the ones who are on the hook for that. And so the one that I use for the win is called JustWorks. Anyone who lives in New York, I'm sure, has seen their subway ads and knows all about them by now. There's a few others. There's one called Namely. There's Bamboo HR and also Workday. And some of these are POEs, like I just mentioned. Some of them are just, all-in-one HR solutions, but where you'll bring your own lawyers and compliance staff. And other than that, you know, I think the onboarding software that I'm most excited about right now, there's a couple. One of them is from Bamboo HR. They're working on an all-in-one onboarding solution to go with the rest of their sort of full package for HR. And there's another one that's in beta from a company called Donuts. It's donut.ai. And I really like Donut and their current product, which is a Slack bot that introduces people for coffee and donuts who don't know each other over Slack.
Mm.
One of the things that we didn't get a chance to talk much about is the huge importance of mentoring connecting stakeholders for employee success. But so Donut is a bot that helps with that. And Donut is working on an onboarding product that is a direct competitor of Aloha, my free Slack bot. And I think if you could take this idea of the drip messaging over Slack and inject it with a bunch of steroids, add things like task management and integration of Donut's introductions into it, as far as I understand, that is what they're building. I think they have Slack as an early beta. They've got a few early beta testers, but it is not live yet unless it went live this week.
Wow. I want this list to be able to share this list with our listeners after the show.
Yeah, I'll definitely send you the link for the notes.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. I'm afraid we're wrapping up on the... we're past the hour.
Yeah, I can see. We just hit it.
Yeah. Well, this has been very interesting for me. The name is Benjamin Jackson. He's the founder of For the Win, which is at ftw.nyc. They're an advising firm in Brooklyn, New York, in Hipsterville. He's been a programmer for 25 years, and he's all about onboarding, which is the way we set expectations and begin an experience with people we're going to work with, people who are going to be our family for maybe years to come.
Building a strong foundation for long-term employee success is how I would describe it.
Duty Now for the Future by Devo. All right. I want to thank you, Ben, and I want to thank you, listeners, and we'll be back soon with another Big Web Show.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Take care.
Take care.